the bank holiday. Wet, windy, and I'm sure I saw a bit of sleet too. But why go outdoors when you can curl up and listen to the radio? This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
And if you've ever been to Beijing, or in fact not just Beijing, but any Chinese city, they're always incredibly busy. It's like it's a bit like New York. It's a 24/7 sort of a city. And there was nobody around. And that was a light bulb moment for sure. I went, this could be very, very serious if this gets out of control.
I was at that hearing with Alex Ferguson and Keane. I took the rap. I said, look, he didn't really say that, but he did really say it. And I didn't make it up, but I did my best to lie to get him off.
I'd say because I'm a bit of a lovey, I think hugging people will be the thing for me.
Ugh.
And we'll start in the afternoon. Colm O'Regan wanted a word about holidays and staycations in the company of Sharon Mannion and Paul Tylak.
The best thing about holidaying this year, whatever happens, expectations are low. Maybe that's the key to happiness, to not expect too much. I'm not saying it's an excuse for bad service. I'm just saying that what constitutes luxury has changed. And you know what? I think hotels, if they just treat us with royalty, we will be glad of anything. Ah, madame, monsieur, welcome to the Travelodge Mullingar. We are honoured you could join us.
Oh, thank you. This is lovely, isn't it?
Very fancy. They have rooms, real rooms with towels and soap and little plastic bottles we can rob. Can you imagine?
Now, of course, this is the lobby. Off to one side, it's a toilet.
Oh, a different toilet.
All of our rooms are equipped as standard with light switches that you won't fully understand until the morning you check out.
Perfect. Light switches that don't make sense. Love it.
But I haven't told you the best bit. Come with me.
Wow. It's a...
That's right. A hotel buffet breakfast. 7 a.m. to 10 a.m.
Natural yogurt in a barrel.
Yes, as much as you can eat.
Eating fruit with a spoon. Imagine.
Yes, the only place you do it in your life.
Look, darling. They have the...
conveyor belt toaster. Oh, I didn't think I'd ever see one of these again.
Yes, this is our pride and joy. You put in your bread and anything could happen. The toast could be burnt. It could be untouched.
It could go missing.
No detail forgotten.
Will there be tanks of rashers made hours before, stuck to each other, shaking with salt?
Of course, madam.
Oh.
A big metal lid hiding a mound of watery scrambled egg?
Only the best.
And with the buffet, do you have beans?
Sir, of course not. But we do have fried tomatoes that no one likes, and you have to order the beans from the mysterious back. And by the time it comes out, breakfast will be officially over. The chef will have gone, but we'll begrudgingly come back to reheat the beans. So the beans will be late, and then you need to...
order fresh tea.
But then the kitchen is closed.
And go back to the conveyor belt toaster.
Which has been removed. The whole room changed to look like lunch, and it's like breakfast never happened.
Magical.
From Colm O'Regan wants a word. And in the morning, Marty Morrissey was talking to former 2FM DJ turned pilot Barry Lang and his return to the airwaves on Classic Hits and his beginnings in pirate radio.
Yeah, those days were sort of back in the pioneering days of pop radio in this country, you know. There wasn't a whole lot of music on the radio at the time. I think Larry Gogan might have been one of the first and the few people who were actually playing pop music on RTE radio. And there were no local stations as well. So except for the pirates that you mentioned earlier, and I was part of that as well. But then 2FM came along to kind of compete with the pirates that were doing so well. Mm. And I got in about a year after 2FM started. And I went into RTE and I did an audition. And around about the same time, Ian Dempsey went in and did the same. And they told us that we weren't being considered for a job. They just wanted to see how we had progressed and how we might possibly in the future be suitable for working on RTE2. And lo and behold, about a week later, both of us got a phone call and we were offered jobs at the weekends. I think Ian started on Saturday and Sunday morning breakfast show and I started Saturday and Sunday evenings 10 to midnight.
Wow.
And it was really a golden phone call for us.
My God, I could imagine the excitement in the Barry Lang house. We're joined by a mutual friend of ours, Barry, actually, Brenda Donoghue, who you know quite well. Tell us, Brenda, how your paths crossed with Barry. I'm sure you have many tales to tell.
When I heard Barry was on, I just had to come down and say hello. Barry, it's great to hear you back on Irish soil and all of that. My first memory of meeting you was I started doing little bits on 2FM myself, and you were well established at this stage. But to come up and see you, you were my first famous person to actually see, because you were doing the Sunday music show on the television as well.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, I've made it. I've just seen Barry Lang.
Yeah. No, we had some good times. We had some crazy times, especially when I was doing the Jeremy Ryan show and you were the sort of regular reporter on that. I mean, some of the projects that they sent you off, even when I was doing the show, were quite outrageous. We had a lot of fun.
It's a big leap, though, isn't it, Barry, to go from being on radio and then becoming an airline pilot. How did that come about? How long did it take? I mean, why flying? Because that's not easy to get into either.
Well, yeah, I know. I think I had never really intended to stay as a broadcaster. It was always my intention to sort of get a real job, if you pardon the expression. Mm. And you probably know exactly what I mean by that. But I needed to do something that was going to be a little bit more challenging. After 18 years of doing radio and television, I felt I needed something that was going to stretch me a little bit. Mm. And I, as a hobby, I had been doing private flying. And it just sort of dawned on me, maybe I could do that. So I reached the ripe old age of 40. And I decided, right, now is a good time to make the move. And I was very lucky. It all came together very nicely. Unfortunately, because of what's happened with COVID, aviation has suffered really, really badly globally. And I became a victim of that. It's not such a big tragedy for me as it is for other people, because I'm at an age now where I should be thinking about retiring. And that's probably pretty much what I'm going to do, at least semi-retirement. So I'm not as badly affected by it all as some others are. Yeah, so I mean, I've had a fabulous career in both broadcasting and now in radio, and I'm looking at doing some part-time radio at the moment as well. Mm. So it's all been very good for me compared to others, you know?
Yeah, well, and richly deserved. Before we go into more recent times, let me just go back, because if I wasn't doing what I was doing, I would probably have eventually gotten into trying to be an airline pilot or at least flying. Is it as glamorous as it sounds?
No, obviously. Nothing is as glamorous as it sounds, no matter what. I mean, the type of flying I was doing was long haul and what they call ultra long haul, so very long flights. I was working for Emirates based out of Dubai. So you could be doing departures out of Dubai. It can be at any time of the day or night, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., coming back home, jet lag from the west coast of the US or from somewhere in Asia. So it can be very busy and it can be very tiring, very challenging, because the studying never stops. To be an airline pilot, you don't just study for your license, get your license and then forget about it. It's an ongoing process. You're always being assessed. You're always having to do some kind of training, some simulator checking. Mm. You have to look after your health because you do medicals on a regular basis. So it's a lot of fun, but there's a lot of pressure attached to it, a lot of stress as well that has to be managed. But I wouldn't change the last 20 plus years for anything. It has been amazing.
And Marty really wanted to know about life in Dubai.
Let's concentrate on Dubai, because the sunshine at the moment would appeal to me. You lived there for 13 years and presumably the lifestyle is fabulous. Tell me about your life in Dubai, away from flying, just being Barry Lang.
Well, yeah, it's exciting and it's otherworldly, I would say, you know, the way they've built it. The high rises. You've been there yourself, Martin.
I have.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. No, I agree with you. And I know, Barry, that the airline paid you a really good tax-free salary and there were very generous allowances as well. So go on, tell us, go on. Just between the two of us, how do the other half live?
Well, the other half live very well, but it is, I mean, it's tax-free out there, pretty much. There is a small VAT charge on some of the goods that you buy out there, but it isn't cheap. It's expensive. You know, people are on big salaries out there because they have to be. So you still have to be just as careful as you are with your money here.
It sounds more glamorous over there, though, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does, but it's never that simple, is it? It always looks a lot better from the outside. But no, it's a great place to live, and I will probably end up retiring there. But the summers are incredibly hot, but the winters are very nice. They're just coming out of their winter season now, so the temperatures will start to increase a little bit now, but still lovely. 25 degrees for about 3 or 4 months of the year. The rest of the time, maybe not so pleasant. It could be 45, even 48, up to 50 degrees sometimes in the summer. Yeah. But then there are lots of indoor things to do. That's what all the shopping malls are about.
Was it a terrible blow, Barry, to you when Emirates made you redundant last year?
It was, as it was for a lot of people, a lot of pilots around the world. There was something like over 300,000 pilots grounded within a very short space of time. And yeah, because nobody knew when they were going to do their last flight. I did mine to Bangkok, a return flight into Dubai. And it was in March of 2020, and I didn't know it was my last flight. It would have been nice to just make the most of it, but that was the case for a lot of people, and still is. People are still waiting to get back into the air. There's some green shoots showing now, and hopefully there will be some kind of a return for the aviation industry. But yeah, it came as a shock. There's no doubt about that.
And was there a kind of one light bulb moment when you realised that COVID was going to alter the world dramatically?
I was like everybody. I didn't think it, before it became a pandemic, I thought this will just go away. This will disappear. Eventually it'll be like SARS and we'll just get back to normal life. But then I did a flight to Beijing, and it's a flight I'd done regularly, done lots of times. And Beijing Capital Airport, it's a very big airport, lots of runways, extremely busy for air traffic going in and out. And you would expect to do some holding. You would expect long delays before you would actually get on the ground. And this one night I flew in there and we had no delays. It looked like we were the only aircraft in the sky on the way in. Landed and looked at all of these Air China aircraft parked in a row all over the airport. They had just grounded almost the entire fleet. And then on the way to the hotel, the streets completely deserted. And if you've ever been to Beijing, or in fact, not just Beijing, but any Chinese city, they're always incredibly busy. It's like, it's a bit like New York. It's a 24/7 sort of a city. And there was nobody around. And that was a light bulb moment for sure. I went, yeah, this could be very, very serious if this gets out of control. Mm. And the rest we know, because it did and became a pandemic.
I know you're home now, but do you still retain connections with Dubai that actually may lure you back to that part of the world?
Yeah, Dubai was my home for the last 13 years. So I still have a home there, and eventually, most likely, I will retire there. But that's a few years away yet. And I've got this new challenge now of my weekend radio shows, which I'm really enjoying. So I'm just going to take that as far as I can and see what happens. There's no pressure to do anything in particular. I've got lots of free time, so I'm devoting a lot of that to just making sure those two shows of the weekend are good. And we'll just see how it goes. You know, it's the beauty of being so close to retirement and not having to worry about too much about making money and that sort of thing. So I can really just sit back and enjoy it a little bit more than I did in the past. And that's exactly what's happening, you know. And we were just about to relaunch. If you remember, Brenda, you remember I used to present a program at Tony Fenton did it and Ian Dempsey did it as well, The Hotline. We're going to start doing that again on Holiday Mondays.
Barry Lang from The Marty Morrissey Show. And in the morning, the situation in Donegal. Here's Mary Wilson.
Donegal is topping the COVID league table for all the wrong reasons at the moment. The county has the highest incidence of the virus in the country, and the northern parts of Donegal, particularly Letterkenny and Milford, have very high numbers indeed. Levels in Donegal have been consistently above the national average since last autumn. The county now has 293.4 cases per 100,000, while the rate nationally is 127.3. The CMO, Dr. Tony Houlihan, called it a concerning level of non-compliance. CMO, the health minister and others met Donegal politicians virtually over the weekend. So what is going on, and why is there such a disparity between the north and the south of the county? Dr. Dennis McCauley is a GP working in Stranorlar. He's chair of the IMO's GP subcommittee. Dr. McCauley, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, mate.
Your own area around Stranorlar is on the high side, but nothing near Letterkenny and Milford at 675. The CMO says there's non-compliance. There are things going on that should not be happening. Is he right?
Yes, He is. I think that people's behaviour has changed, but I think it is a countrywide issue. Why is it so why is it so exaggerated in North Donegal? I think the important thing to realise is the good efforts of the people of Donegal is being diluted because of the border. And the border in North Donegal is very much an open border. There's always mixing from an economic, a social and a recreational point of view. So I think you have to always take into effect that the good work of Donegal people is affected if there is an outbreak, a relatively high outbreak in Northern Ireland, and any behavioural sort of deviation is exaggerated. If you have a party and there's a group of young people from Northern Ireland who are at it who have a higher rate than the person and the other people at the rest of the party, that just has effects. And I think that the influence of the border is very important in North Donegal. And unfortunately, now that the hospitality sector in the rest of Northern Ireland is open, I think unfortunately that border effect may become more noticeable along the border generally.
Is it fair though, or indeed is it too simplistic to say that the good work of Donegal is being undone by Derry, you know, placing the blame on the other side?
No, I'm not. It isn't a judgment. It's just a fact. I think that you mentioned that Donegal has never been below the national average. Actually, it was below the national average in around January, February, and that was surprise, because Derry was below the national average in a Northern Ireland context. So, no, I'm not trying to blame a third party. I'm just saying that there is a third factor that you have to be aware. South Donegal generally doesn't mix that openly with Enniskillen and County Tyrone. They have an incidence which is a quarter of the national average. So you have to look at the actual factors. I'm not saying that there's a problem and we have to sort it out, but there are other factors other than the bad behaviour, inverted commas, of the population of Donegal.
And I know that Paul Reid said you don't want to stigmatise any county, but is there bad behaviour?
Yeah, I would imagine so. I would imagine so. I think there has to be if there has been a spread. But I'm actually in North Donegal as we speak, and in a zone which was high 2 weeks ago because the rate in Derry was very high, is now dropping because the rate in Derry is now beginning to drop also. So I think there are birthday parties in Kerry, Kilkenny and Donegal. But unfortunately, I think the effect of a birthday party in Donegal may be more exaggerated if there is a group of young people who are more infected than the people of the Donegal present, and unfortunately the rate in Derry is about 160 per 100,000, but the problem is that it's concentrated amongst the 20 and the 30 year olds because the rest of the population is vaccinated. So you have a high concentration of a virus in a young group. That young group come to Donegal to holiday at the weekends, and if they're in a room with a number of people from Donegal, the rate of infection amongst the Donegal people will go up to the same level as those from Derry. So it is a factor, but if that birthday party wasn't taking place, that infection wouldn't actually occur.
Donegal-based GP Dr. Dennis McCauley for Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson. And in the morning, Chloe Agnew was telling Marty Morrissey about her new project, The X Collective.
It's a brand new collaborative platform for artists, creatives of all different skill sets within our industry. We have artists, songwriters, producers, videographers, directors, we have it all. And it's basically a community for different creatives, as I said, of all kinds to come together and to be able to collaborate and work on projects that they might not normally get a chance to do in their own worlds. And myself and Zaffo, my incredibly talented co-writer and producer of that song you just heard there, WB, we met each other about over 2 years ago on a songwriters camp, and we hit it off straight away. And that's where this little track was born, and it's been over 2 years in the works, so to finally see it out there in the world and flying with its own set of wings now is really, really exciting.
Well, I have to say, Chloe, it's a great sound. I mean, the track is just brilliant. I believe, however, you set out to pitch it to an existing girl band and then thought better of it.
Indeed, we did. That's where initially we were planning on putting it. And then, as I said, in the spirit of the X Collective, we decided to kind of create our own little girl band. And we pulled in amazing talents like Gemma Bradley, Sunita Tushin. And we decided to create our own little girl gang energy for 2021. Mm. So it's been such a joy to work on, for me to just have something different, a different outlet in my music world, for me to express something different and to write something completely new and fresh is really, really exciting. And they're just the best group of people to work with. It's one thing creating music with really talented musicians, but it's really special to create music with really special human beings too.
And it's very different again. I mean, it's a new kind of road to follow for Chloe Agnew. Lockdown has been notoriously harsh for musicians as a group, and I know you had a big tour plan last year with Celtic Woman, which was cancelled. How have you coped generally, Chloe?
Oh, it's been, I think, as many people will say, it's been a rough roller coaster of ups and downs this last year. And yeah, I think seeing the industry be just at a loss of where it's going to go next, I really can only hope that things are on the up now. The only blessing has been I didn't really write or be creative for the first part of the lockdown last year because I was, like many other people, so filled with anxiety and worry of where we were going to go next and confusion of how I had so many dates lined up for last year, and then when it all went upside down, I had no idea what was going to be next. But thankfully, wonderfully creative people, getting the chance to work with them over the dreaded Zooms, but it's been a blessing actually getting to still create virtually and really work as hard as we can to still keep our creative spirits high and hope that when things come back in full, we'll have loads of things to put out there into the world from this crazy, bizarre time.
But Chloe, trying to do something on Zoom, particularly musically, I mean, I couldn't even begin to think how difficult that would be.
Yeah, it's not the easiest, but it's possible. It is. Mm. I mean, it definitely doesn't have the same energy and the same vibe that you have in a room creating with your colleagues and your musicians. I cannot wait to get back to that. But I didn't think it was possible, but it has been a really wonderful thing the last kind of 6 months of the year, getting a chance to work and write with people over Zoom that you would never normally meet, people who are in different parts of the world. Mm. It's not the easiest, but yes, it is. It is doable, and it's been really, thank God for it in the last couple of months, because
absolutely,
I've been really, really thankful to having that to keep me going.
Well, what you've done is I think it's just wonderful. During COVID, on a personal basis, mentally and physically, have you formed good or bad habits?
A bit of both. I certainly drink more red wine now than I ever did before.
That's okay. That's good. That's fine. It's good for your heart.
I've taken better with self care and self love and all of that being the only thing we have to grab on to in the last year. I really have put more of a focus on. I never thought I would be a walker and a runner, but I absolutely. It's been the only thing I guess we've had for the last year. But I definitely have put more of an attention on trying to look after myself in a better way. As she says, she drinks more red wine, but I think a healthy combination of both is good for you. And it's taken me getting to a place to really, the only preservation for my mental health has been that of trying to look after myself in a bit better way, and also just having good people around you, you know, having, thank God for my family, for my friends who have kept me sane, as semi-sane I guess this last year in the madness of it all, but God bless them, because it's been a strange year that I cannot wait to see the back of.
Oh, so say all of us.
Yes, but what is Chloe most looking forward to?
Hugging people, my goodness, I miss that. I miss hugging friends. I miss seeing people who I love. I really do. I'm hopeful for all of the work and the time that I know a lot of us have put into the arts and the entertainment world over the last year. We've been kind of persevering and really trying to keep the faith that things are going to come back. And I really do hope that when they come back, people, as I've said before, will have a new appreciation for the arts and for artists and for their local venues and the things that they took for granted maybe beforehand. And when you see that arts and music and film and books have kept people alive this last year, I really hope that when they come back, they'll flock back to their theatres more than ever and support their local venue, support the arts and the creative world, because it's been so badly hit. And I can only hope that the time, as I said, that we've all put into to creating stuff during lockdown, I hope that it's going to be a place for it all to come out and give us a chance to show what we've been working on.
Chloe Agnew from The Marty Morrissey Show. And on the news at 1, Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan wants the vaccinated older generation to get out and enjoy life again. Here's Gavin Jennings.
The Chief Medical Officer has urged people who have been vaccinated against COVID to start enjoying life again. In an open letter today, Dr. Tony Houlihan says, those of you who are vaccinated thus far are mostly those we recommended to cocoon at the outset of the pandemic. You can now get back out there and restart many things you used to do once restrictions ease from May the 10th. That might be visiting the seaside, a trip to a museum, a visit with a friend, or a trip to see your grandchildren at long last. It's important that you look out for the public health advice that is relevant to you and to plan to do it safely. But it's important to get on and do it specifically, and those who are vaccinated to get back out there and start doing the things that they enjoy doing. On Friday, he clarified that people are considered fully vaccinated 1 week after their second dose of Pfizer, 2 weeks after their second dose of Moderna, 2 weeks after their second dose, sorry, 2 weeks after their second, their one only dose of Johnson & Johnson, apologies for the confusion there, and 4 weeks after a first dose of AstraZeneca, or if they have had a PCR confirmed case of COVID-19 in the last 6 months. Sarah Lennon is Executive Director of Sage Advocacy, who provides support for older people, vulnerable adults and healthcare patients. And she joins us now on the line. Sarah Lennon, good afternoon to you and thanks for taking our call today.
Good afternoon, Gavin. Thank you.
The people that you work with, will they be encouraged by this advice?
They will. And I think that this is very strong leadership by the Chief Medical Officer and an important acknowledgement by him indeed that while we've all sacrificed and curbed our normal routine, so to speak, there are some among us who have sacrificed more than others, including our older people and those who've been most medically at risk throughout the pandemic.
He says, while anxiety is understandable, you can have confidence in your vaccine no matter which one you received. Is there an anxiousness about going out, meeting up with family and friends, having them into your house?
There is. And I would ask people, I suppose, to pause for a moment and think that actually among us, some of our older people, there's been an anxiety, I suppose, all the time before the pandemic within their community and indeed an isolation. And actually one of the best things to come out of the pandemic has been that sort of community response to those among us who may be older and picking up shopping for people, calling in your neighbour. And I think that we really need to try to retain that community spirit as we get back to our so-called normal lives. And I think for a lot of older people, they've been bombarded with messages throughout the pandemic of the risks associated with this. So it's a big step out, to step out into the unknown in some cases. And while the reassurances from the CMO are a very important part of that, I think there will need to be a gradual reintroduction. And it falls upon all of us to make sure that we're thinking about everybody else in our community as well as ourselves.
Sarah, separately, the Irish Independent is reporting today on proposals to exempt rental income from family homes, from contributions to the Fair Deal scheme. What do you think?
I think we need to think about what the impact again on older people would be. If we're talking about making rental property tax-free, that could create a situation where people are being coerced into nursing homes. Sage Advocacy has encountered that, where there's been coercion or even people have been tricked into nursing home care. And on the other hand, there have been situations where people have experienced financial hardships. So, well, you know, it's important that we're having conversations about Fair Deal. We really do need a root and branch overhaul of the system and indeed a refocusing on home care. So not about renting out your room, but staying in your own home for as long as you can with the supports that you need to stay there.
Sarah Lennon on the News at 1 with Gavin Jennings. And on Colm O'Regan wants a word in the company of Deirdre O'Kane. Colm was looking forward to the holidays.
Deirdre, are you now Zen Buddhist about expectations about your holiday? Will anything do you at this stage?
Pretty much as long as I'm out of this house. Yeah, I need to get out of here. But yeah, I think that very sound advice is to lower your expectations. Expect nothing. But generally speaking, I find Irish people do that in relation to summer holidays in Ireland anyway. You know, we don't know if we're going to get good or bad weather or anything in between. So we expect the worst. And then if you get a good day, well, fabulous. You think you've won the lotto.
What is the most ordinary thing once you leave the house and just start heading away from home that you will think, right, Now we're back to normal. And is it a hotel? Is it just a normal pub? What's that little something?
I'd say, because I'm a bit of a lovey, I think hugging people will be the thing for me. Hugging people.
Ugh.
You know,
you're absolute pervert.
I know, but we're lovies, darling. We do the kisses on the cheeks and the whole lot, and I miss it terribly.
Are you going to go?
Just you're a countryman.
Yeah, I'm a countryman. Yeah. Anyway. I'll punch somebody in the shoulder and say, "What's the crack?"
Probably loved this elbowing, have you? Because you're from the country.
I don't elbow, and it hugging softened us up anyway. That's how we got into this mess. I didn't even touch elbows with anyone. My elbows are actually pristine. Yeah, right. So let's say we get to the hotel. You're checked in on that getaway. The problem with holidaying in Ireland, though, is can you feel that you've truly got away?
Having a nice time, love?
Oh, it's just so great to get away a weekend without talking about COVID. What do you want to do tonight?
Oh, let's go to a restaurant.
Okay, I'll book one.
You are through to Torino's authentic Italian restaurant. Due to restrictions, all our tables are outdoors and they're all booked up tonight. And so is the Indian and the Chinese up the town, so don't bother ringing them either.
Aw.
You know what, love? I don't even mind if we stay in the hotel. Let's just watch telly, chill out.
And tonight on RTE1, the best of the last 12 months of The Late Late Show. 3 hours of all opening up about mental health, the starkest warnings from every interview with every NPHET member, and Nathan Carter's first cousin once removed talking about how COVID has affected his mental health.
Oh, COVID. Mental health. I've had enough of that. Look, try the BBC.
BBC News tonight. What to do with all your spare vaccines? Yes, you can now vaccinate your cat. This is because we have a load of vaccines and you don't, especially Ireland.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I think there's a band on in the hotel bar.
Oh, great idea. It's been so long since I've seen live music.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for our band. You will recognise him as the expert on the telly about COVID, but he also plays music. It's Luke O'Neill.
Ah, for four!
Tuesday is just as bad.
So this is the last summer for you to discover your country, maybe. Those of you who like to go somewhere unspoilt and off the beaten track, it's going to be harder and harder this year because there's just going to be so many other people around staycationing. So now, in order to find somewhere that isn't full of tourists, it's time for Ireland's terrible towns to step it up. You know Ireland's terrible towns, the ones recovering from a bypass. They've been hollowed out by decades of neglect because there wasn't a minister. There's a Lidl at the roundabout, but 25 closed pubs in the main street. You can buy clothing in the Joe Biden super duper petrol station at the motorway exit 20 miles away, but you can't buy a stamp up the town. But now, terrible towns, it's your time to shine.
Welcome to Ireland's Forgotten Middle. Let the unspoiled towns of Ireland spoil you. One wide street, many worlds.
Wander amongst the grim apartments built in a field with no play area, half of which are owned by the local TD.
Stay in our hotel with a grey mid-90s Grundig telly chained to the ceiling that only gets Airtel and a room key attached to a brick.
Select from our choice of 1. Beers at our off-license come undertakers.
In the evenings, head along to your local fairy fort, where the local far right will be invoking our Celtic heritage to argue that George Soros wants to replace the Irish with foreigners.
And there's a fight for everyone outside the local chipper.
Ireland's terrible towns.
Do you want your go, do you?
From Colm O'Regan wants a word. And on the Marty Morrissey Show, journalist and broadcaster Eamon Dunphy.
Well, I want to start by asking you about how you've fared over the past year or so. I know you have emphysema, so you've had to be terribly careful. You must be missing the kids, grandkids, but you've had the comfort of a happy home with your wife. So how do you mind each other?
Well, we work here. We have a studio built for the podcast. I've missed my children and my grandchildren, my friends, of course. But we're luckier than many people. We have space and we're not confined, as many families are, with children. whatever age they are, people living in confined circumstances, people who aren't able to work because the business isn't functioning. So compared to most people, we're very fortunate, Marty, but it's been a long time and it has been trying for many, many people.
What did you find the most difficult? Was it just being away from people?
Yes. In our case, as I say, we're very fortunate. You do miss, I think, the simple things in life, going to the shops, going for a meal, either a date night or with one of my pals, and just being able to make those spontaneous decisions. You have to think very carefully. And in my case, I had to cocoon because of if I had got the virus, I think it would have been a very bad outcome. So, you know, it has been very trying for people. It's a very, very long time. And so many people have to worry about their businesses, about their jobs, about their futures. And of course, they have to worry about getting the virus if you're in a, you know, a house with a family, a growing family. Anybody can catch it, bring it in, spread it. People have lived with those fears for about 15 months now. So it's been a really horrible time, and I think people won't forget it for the rest of their lives.
Oh, that's true. And thank God you're fine and your family are fine. I mentioned the podcast earlier, The Stand, has a huge following at this stage and is a regular in the iTunes top 10. That must be very satisfying, Eamon, especially because finally, I suppose, you're your own boss.
Yes, it is. We have a really big audience and we do our thing. I am my own boss, yeah. So, yes, I mean, I like working. I enjoy the podcast. I enjoy the interaction with listeners. And I'm still very interested in current affairs, sport, all kinds of stuff. And as you say, I'm my own boss. So if there's any row, it's with myself.
Podcasting reminds us about how journalism has changed since we were young ones, all of us back in the day. We've a clip here of yourself, Eamon, and Johnny Giles on Nighthawks with the late Shea Healy. Let's have a listen.
Now, what about the game today? Seriously, sum it up for us. Did you enjoy it, apart from the fact that we won?
I don't think it was a very good game, really, but it wasn't the game itself today. It was the actual official qualification for the World Cup finals. It was the event, not the game itself.
And were they scrubby little goals, Eamon, do you reckon?
There's no such thing, Shay. It's a scrubby little goal. This team has made history. And there's no such thing as a bad goal. Today was for generations of people in this country. This was the day for soccer, and it was a day for Jimmy McGee, Jack Charlton, Ireland.
You have a big
Opal.
There's something up
here. Arnold O'Byrne, let's not forget Arnold. Arnold, the man behind Opal, the man who really makes the Irish team buzz.
Tick. You told me he never laughed.
Well, Eamon, what are your memories of that particular night?
I think we'd had a few jars.
I think so too.
John certainly had a few Bacardis. We ended up singing, but it was a great programme, Nighthawks. And Shay, God rest him, who passed away last week, was a terrific guy, very talented man, very nice man. And there was a buzz there, and I was... in what they call good form, Martin.
Yeah, I can hear it. I can hear it years later.
We had a good time.
And absolutely.
I think there was a bit of slagging going on and mockery, but it was good humour. I saw a clip of it there in the last few days when they were remembering Shay, and it made me laugh.
Absolutely. Have we become overly politically correct, Eamon, do you think?
Yes. Probably we have. Obviously, we have to be more respectful than we used to be about people of different beliefs and identities, and that's proper. But there is a kind of, there is a danger that you can't have fun, you can't make fun of certain things and certain people. And of course, there's an army of politically correct people waiting to jump on any perceived error or transgression. So, yes, I mean, Irish people in particular are decent on the whole, and the kind of racism and stuff you see in other countries isn't really present here, or hostility to people of a different sexual orientation. This is a tolerant country largely now. It never used to be, of course, but the Irish people, in relative terms, I think, are tolerant. And there's not so much bigotry. So it's good that these people are rooted out when they sort of raise their ugly heads. But you have to have a laugh as well. And, you know, if you can't laugh at yourself, if you can't laugh in general, it's not healthy.
And Marty took Eamon back to 1990.
Well, I'm going to bring you back to those great days of Johnny Giles, Liam Brady, and of course, the wonderful Bill O'Hurley, because this is one of my favourite clips. After Ireland could only draw with Egypt at the World Cup in 1990, I know you've seen this so many times, but I have to on a radio bank holiday. You were accused of saying you were ashamed to be Irish, but
yeah,
Bill O'Hurley.
No,
but
yeah.
Bill O'Hurley subsequently clarified that this is what you said.
I felt embarrassed for soccer, embarrassed for the country, embarrassed for all the good players, for our great tradition in soccer. This has nothing to do with the players who played today. That's a good side. I feel embarrassed and ashamed of that performance.
Would you go as strongly as that about it?
John never goes as strongly as me on anything, but I'm thinking of men like him, Tommy Eglinton, all the great players we produced, Peter Farrells, the great football, the Liam Brady's, the Ronnie Whelan's, the David O'Leary's. This is a great football and country produced players and go out and play that rubbish.
The throwing of the pen was just magic in some ways when you think back. I mean, I presume that was just purely instinctive.
I just dropped it, actually. I was fed up with it. It was a big day, Marty, for Irish soccer. It was a Sunday. And we were playing Egypt, who were a country we would have been expected to beat. And it was for, you know, the big prize of going forward in the tournament. And the whole country shut down. The GAA shut down. They put up big screens in every community in Ireland, including in GAA clubs.
They did.
And it was a day, in my mind, a very emotional day. There was Irish flags hanging out of windows. And it was an afternoon kickoff. And for once, I'd grown up at a time when the Gaelic players and indeed fans were banned from going to soccer matches, when soccer was a kind of despised West Brit game. And now on this wonderful day, the whole country was focused on our game, my game, John's game. And we made holy hames of it. It was a very negative performance. Egypt were much better, actually, than we thought they'd be, resilient, and we never played the kind of football we ought to be playing. Ronnie Whelan had been left on the bench, and Ronnie was a wonderful player. He just captained Liverpool to win the first division that year. So I was very, very disappointed and emotional about the whole thing, and I suppose that explained my sort of venom.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was a price to be paid by everyone concerned, including RTE, who got, I think, 2,000 phone calls in the next 20 minutes. And, of course, the media the next day, and then I was gone to Italy. And it was a pretty horrible time. But I did my thing and, you know, stuff happens.
Indeed, one of the things you did was, of course, that you wrote, you ghosted Roy Keane's book. He seemed to regret the first autobiography because he was still a professional footballer at the time and it got him into trouble. Presumably, you've no such regrets that you did the Roy Keane book.
No, I don't. He asked me to do it. He got a very good deal, and I did, from the publishers, which were Penguin. The book sold enormous numbers of copies. I think it's the second best-selling hardback book of any description in British publishing history, because it coincided, the publication, with Saipan. Now, because he was captain of Manchester United at the time, he was very constrained in what he could say. And even though he is a very forthright speaker now, and indeed he was as a player, there were certain things from the dressing room he couldn't tell me. So it was an interesting exercise. I liked him and his family, his five children. His wife is a lovely woman, whose father comes from Dublin, actually. And there's a lot to like about Roy Keane in private. And I did it. It was good for me and it was good for him in terms of the money he made. However, it wasn't... Alfinge Haaland, and he had this incredible feud, really. And for statements Roy made, which were in the book, he paid a heavy price. I think he got a big fine, and I think it was a 9-game ban. But I was at that hearing with Alex Ferguson and Keane, and I took the rap. I said, look, he didn't really say that. I kind of made it up. But he did really say it. And I didn't make it up. But I did my best to lie to get him off.
Eamon Dunphy from The Marty Morrissey Show. And on Morning Ireland, Vincent Kearney, our Northern editor, explained how Northern Ireland is marking 100 years of its existence after the island of Ireland was partitioned on the 3rd of May 1921.
We're going north. It was a minute past midnight on the 3rd of May 1921 when a border appeared on the island of Ireland. Six of the 32 counties officially became part of what was a new legal and constitutional entity known as Northern Ireland. Britain's King George V came to Belfast for the state opening held 7 weeks after Northern Ireland was created in law. Well, 100 years on, there are no official celebrations planned to mark today's centenary. Our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney, joins me now. And Vincent, it's historically significant, but is it unusual or indeed strange that there are no official events planned to mark the 100 years?
I think certainly unionists would say they find it very strange indeed that there are no official events. If you've spoken to unionists a number of years ago about this upcoming centenary, they'd have expected some kind of fanfare, some kind of celebrations, perhaps even parades. But a number of factors have conspired against that. There's, of course, the COVID restrictions still ongoing, which mean there can be no mass outdoor gatherings. That's perhaps fortuitous in a sense because of the political sensitivities that would mitigate against such large-scale parades, because there are real sensitivities around it. Many unionists want to celebrate 100 years of Northern Ireland. Many nationalists and republicans say, as far as they're concerned, there's nothing whatsoever to celebrate. And the British government itself, the approach it has taken is marking the centenary with a series of events. It's funding those events to the tune of £3 million. There are online seminars. There are historical reflections. Now, of course, there will be local communities in Northern Ireland who will perhaps hold their own events. But on an official level, it is very low-key indeed, and I think that will surprise most people.
But there is a message today from Queen Elizabeth.
There is indeed a message issued just a short time ago from Queen Elizabeth to the people of Northern Ireland. She describes this as a very significant event. Says the anniversary reminds us of our complex history, provides an opportunity to reflect on togetherness and that diversity. Also wishes to recognise the important contribution made, she says, by our friends and closest neighbours towards the success of Northern Ireland. The statement from Queen Elizabeth says she looks back with fondness on the visit that she made with Prince Philip to Ireland 10 years ago this month. She says she treasures many memories and the spirit of goodwill that she saw at first hand. And it concludes by saying that across generations, the people of Northern Ireland are choosing to build an inclusive, prosperous and hopeful society, strengthened by the gains of the peace process. She says, may this be our guiding thread in the coming years. And the Queen signs off by saying she sends her warmest good wishes to the people of Northern Ireland. And that's one of a number of statements. We also have one from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and another from Northern Ireland Secretary of State Brandon Lewis. So certainly at an official level, there are statements, but no celebrations.
Okay. Northern editor Vincent Carney for Morning Ireland. And in the morning, Marty was talking to our Eurovision hopeful, Leslie Roy.
It's Leslie Roy, MAPS, and I love it, absolutely. Leslie Roy, good morning.
Good morning, Marty. How's it going?
Very well indeed. Lovely to speak to you and thank you for joining us. You're a County Dublin girl, but you've built your career and life with your wife in New York, am I right?
Yeah, Balbriggan, born and raised, and I've been working there from about 13, 14 years on and in some way or another in the music industry. And I eventually got a record deal in the States and, you know, took the leap and went over to New York. And, you know, we had an album that we worked for 3 years on. And then I got to, tour all over the States before now kind of taking this journey to come back home.
Mm. And how did you come to get involved in Eurovision? Is it an event that would have been on your radar from a young age growing up in Balbriggan?
Yeah, completely. I think like a lot of us, like you just said, you know, the legendary status that we have in the Eurovision. I grew up watching it, you know, when we had the back-to-back wins, and it was something that I was always very aware of, and I loved it growing up. Me and my sister would do the scoreboards every single year, so it was something that I was definitely aware of. It wasn't the first thing on my list that I wanted to do as a songwriter, but it was definitely on there, and, you know, it was a matter of timing for me and songs. And if I could send something in, and then just something kind of, a light bulb went off for me in, I guess, November 2019 to just send in Story of My Life and take it from there.
So Eurovision brought you back home. Your wife is American, isn't she?
Yes, correct.
And how does she find Ireland?
She loves Ireland. No, she's been coming back with me for Christmas and birthdays over the past 12 years. So she loves it. And, you know, we've done the lockdown for the past 4 or 5 months in Balbriggan, and, you know, we took my grandmother in, so she totally understands and loves Irish life. And she, you know, talk about an American that loves the Eurovision, is definitely Lauren.
Nice to have the granny with you though, isn't it, Leslie? That's great. She must be so proud of you. You must have been devastated when the competition was cancelled last year, but you must also, at the other end of the spectrum of emotion, you must be delighted to be given a second chance.
Exactly. I mean, look, like everybody experienced, some form of loss one way or another, and people in many, many worse ways than just the competition being cancelled. So I, let that go and buried that fairly quickly on and just tried to figure out how and if I wanted to try and write a song and look at it for next year, because there was never any guarantee that this was even ever going to go ahead. So, it was upsetting at the time, but it was really kind of short-lived and into the next thing, you know.
What do you say to those who would argue that Eurovision has changed too much and drifted too far from its roots?
Yeah, I mean, I think that can be said for anything in the arts world, you know. Music, the music industry has changed enormously over the past 10 years, and it will continue to change enormously. The same way, you know, you were talking about football there before I got on, you know, the sports world has changed dramatically. Like if you look at an old soccer game and look at a soccer game now, like the speed at which the athletes move is completely different, and it's the same with music.
Leslie Roy from the Marty Morrissey Show. And on the news at one, Cian McCormack on life after the pandemic and learning to live with hugs, handshakes and germs.
The microbiome is the kind of constituents of the organisms that live within and on us.
Liam Fanning, a UCC professor of immunovirology, is defining our microbiome.
So that composition of that community of bacteria, fungi and viruses is like, it's an ecosystem that lives within us, but that, you know, we feed it and we benefit from it.
Our bodies are like rainforests and house a vast ecosystem of organisms, but the pandemic may have had an adverse effect.
While on some levels they might threaten us, and on other levels we depend on them to provide us with certain types of nutrients, to digest certain types of food, some instances maybe to provide a defence mechanism by educating our immune system against some more pathogenic bacteria.
To stave off COVID-19, we're washing our hands, keeping apart, wearing masks and zapping surfaces with sprays that promise to kill germs. And some of those germs make us healthy.
And if we start zapping everything around us, which we have with COVID, we're actually taking away plenty of these beneficial microbes.
Recently, a global group of health researchers published a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, raising the alarm on this. Dr. Brett Finlay is the first author of the study and a professor of microbiology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
History has shown us that when we deprive ourselves of these microbes, bad things happen. And so we're worried that we are depriving ourselves of these microbes due to COVID, and this is having consequences downstream. And we're going to really see this in the early kids and the elderly, especially, because that's when the microbes have the biggest effect. I mean, an early baby really needs microbial exposure to develop their brain normally, their gut normally, their immune system normally. And as you get older, post 65, your microbes fall off a cliff. And a lot of studies show that if you can be exposed to younger people's microbes kind of thing and good microbes, it actually helps prevent these microbes going bad on you, which hastens the aging process. So we predict we're going to see, you know, probably an increase in asthma and obesity, especially in the next 3 to 5 years post-COVID.
But can we live with germs again when staying apart led to a decline in colds and flus? Again, Professor Liam Fanning.
The flu season this year was practically non-existent. It's questionable as to whether we'll have much of a flu season coming, because I think people have probably accepted, the wearing of masks and the prevention of transmission of infections. So we have a much more educated population. And I think for some people, masks and that kind of protection will be here to stay.
If normality is to resume again, can we go back to the pre-pandemic social norms of hugging, shaking hands, or even crowding into a room? Again, Professor Brett Finlay.
From how we function as a species, we really do need to get back to sharing microbes extensively, because we know that's very beneficial. You know, whatever you can do to sort of keep your microbes healthy, yet still stay away from COVID, obviously, to get vaccinated, you know, you do have to follow these health precautions. There's a reason. It's the only tools we have to it. But I think this is another experiment post-COVID. How do we behave? And I know I find myself backing away from complete strangers when I previously wouldn't have done that for no apparent reason. It's just human behavior. You know, we're so trained to be paranoid of each other now. And this is not good for microbial transmission.
And as social tactile creatures, can we get our heads around resuming normality and living with germs again? Dr. Trudy Meehan, a senior clinical psychologist at the RCSI Centre for Positive Psychology and Health.
So I think we will definitely get back there, because all of our drives push us to be social and we're social creatures, but there'll probably be different pathways for different people in that. So we're going to have to go through a period of adjustment where some people are going to run out into the world really happy to get back there, and other people are going to have more heightened anxiety and more fears. And we're going to have to tolerate quite a bit of difference, I think, for a while until things settle down.
Cian McCormack from the News at One. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.